This podcast is presented by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at www.uctv.tv. Enjoy the presentation.
Good evening. Welcome to CNS News. I'm Jill Replogle.
And I'm Jordan Ehrlich. After a storm of advertising and media coverage, Super Tuesday is all over. Now the candidates are focusing on the delegate counts. Our political analyst, Michael Filtz, explains.
Thanks, Jordan. In a typical election year, Super Tuesday's voting extravaganza tends to separate the winning candidates from the losers. This year, that may not be the case. What's turning out to be more important are the actual delegate counts. Let's take a look at some numbers.
At the Republican convention in September, the winning candidate will need 1,191 delegates to win the nomination. After this week's Super Tuesday, John McCain emerges the clear frontrunner with 703 delegates. After a second-place run, Romney suspended his campaign and has not yet announced who he'll support. And while Mike Huckabee saw a surge in popularity during Super Tuesday, he's still pulling far behind McCain. Barring a drastic change, it's becoming likely that John McCain will take the nomination. But the Dems have an entirely different story. At their Denver convention in August, the winning candidate will need 2,025 delegates to claim the nomination. While Hillary Clinton won both New York and California on Super Tuesday, she retains only a small delegate lead over Barack Obama, who won more states but fewer delegates. If the two candidates keep running neck and neck, the contest may remain too close to call, even after the delegate-rich Texas primary on March 4th. We may have to wait until a nail-biter in Pennsylvania on April 22nd, where 188 delegates are up for grabs. After that, only 10 states will remain, and if it's still too close to call, the convention in Denver will be the final battleground. Stay tuned for more on this exciting race.
In San Francisco, voters had more than presidential races to consider. Also at stake was the fate of one of the city's most historic monuments. Lucy Schwartz has the story.
Even on this rainy winter's day, tourists whipped out their wallets to see one of San Francisco's biggest attractions, Alcatraz.
Well, my son gave me a Christmas present of coming up to San Francisco, and I decided that Alcatraz was one of the things I wanted to see.
It's kind of famous. That's why we come here.
I think it's a significant part of history, and I think it's a big tourist attraction here in San Francisco.
Just listen to the purity of this sound.
But a Marin County artist and activist has other plans for the historic monument. Knock it down, and he's gone as far as putting the issue on the ballot.
Proposition C is a policy initiative asking the city and county of San Francisco to consider acquiring Alcatraz Island for the express purpose of turning it into a global peace center.
He's even created a template of what he would want to build in the prison's place.
It's like a Statue of Liberty type of project. It's something that's sitting out there in the middle of the bay, which everybody sees, that's powerful, and it speaks on a really powerful level to us in terms of what I call truth, beauty, and goodness.
And David is not the only one who would like to see the prison come down. He collected 18,000 signatures to get his vision on the ballot. It's supported by Native Americans who consider Alcatraz Island a sacred site.
To me, it's like taking away the negative, dark history that some people seem to want to be tourists and glorify, you know, the new way of, like, being heading toward peace.
But this man doesn't agree. He thinks closing down Alcatraz would be a serious blow to San Francisco's economy.
It's insane. It's insanity. It's a waste of time. Destroying Alcatraz will destroy jobs, will take away revenue, and will basically destroy one of San Francisco's greatest attractions.
San Francisco voters agreed. A majority of them voted no to Proposition C on February 5th. But David isn't giving up.
I'm not like, it's got to happen now. I mean, this is 21st century project.
For now, the prison isn't going anywhere. This is Lucy Schwartz for CNS News.
Recruiters in Berkeley may be moving on after a recent city council vote that sparked national debate. Gabriel Lee takes us there.
Last week, the Berkeley City Council voted to send a letter to this Marine recruiting center on Shattuck Avenue, saying that the Marines were, quote, uninvited and unwelcome intruders. They also dedicated a parking space for 4 hours a week to a group called Code Pink.
Code Pink is an awesome grassroots women's peace organization, and now we've been working to end war.
But not everybody supports the city's recent actions.
There was a guy who drove by this morning, a white guy, and he yelled out, you're so dirty, take a bath.
After passing the initiatives, the city received over 1,000 angry letters, and a Republican senator from South Carolina has begun drafting legislation to strip Berkeley of federal funds. But Zan believes that the people of Berkeley are behind them.
We're Berkeley. Oh, 99.9% of the people are like, Yeah.
At first, the Marines refused to comment.
I don't. I have no comment. Okay. Yeah.
But later, a spokesperson said that they have no plans to change or cease operations. He said that the center would keep business as usual.
And we have a presence that says no more business as usual.
In the meantime, two city council members are introducing legislation to rescind the original letter due to the overwhelmingly negative email response. The council is set to vote again next Tuesday.
And now the hunter becomes the hunted as CNS News reporter Joe Bush finds himself part of a story he went out to cover.
French filmmaker Julian LeConte is making a documentary about Berkeley students' passion for politics.
What drives this generation to move forward, to get politically involved and have a say in changing American society, changing the political landscape?
Just before Super Tuesday, Julian walked around Sproul Plaza looking for the right people to interview.
All right, thanks.
He looked.
Obviously, Super Tuesday coming up.
And looked.
Where are you? We need to film you. I'll be right back.
And looked.
Tu crois qu'il aurait quelque chose à dire sur les jeunes aujourd'hui?
C'est pour ça, ouais, vas-y, allons-y.
Non, mais t'as lui à poser une question ou pas?
Ouais, j'ai vu.
On this day, he chose Stephanie Chan, a youth coordinator for the Obama campaign.
And through her eyes, we get a sense of how this generation is taking, you know, the future of this country also, taking decisions.
He says Stephanie represents real change.
She comes from a, you know, conservative family, a Catholic, who traditionally votes Republican, and she actually convinced now her family to vote Democrat, to vote for Obama.
Then Julian wanted to turn the cameras on me. I agreed to be interviewed in the film because I felt I had something to say.
As a Marine, I fought for my country, and I love my country. I'm a patriot. And as a journalist, I do the same thing. I fight for us. And this is how I'm making a difference, is being a journalist. That's how I'm trying to make a difference in my country, the things that I don't like and the things I think are wrong, to tell the people.
French viewers will be very surprised to find that this country is about a young generation that is extremely committed.
The film will air on the French documentary channel just weeks before the November elections. But will it be effective?
I think I have to leave it to the French audience. And I have to wait until it's broadcast to find out exactly what they're going to think about it.
In Berkeley, Joe Bush, CNS News.
We'll be right back after our first look at Bay Area reactions to the presidential primaries.
Ready for Clinton?
Ready.
Thank you.
My name is Sujesh. I've been living here for 10 years, and it's the first time I'm voting. I feel she's the best on most of the issues that really concern me, economy, Iraq, healthcare. And I'm gay, and as a gay individual, her positions on LGBT issues, it's great.
Can you think for a second about what you think was the first election you ever voted in?
Kennedy, President Kennedy, 1963.
Every single one since I've been 18.
I was 18 and Jimmy Carter, Reagan, one of those.
This is the extreme election of a lifetime.
I just want to see change.
Can we get somebody that can run this country is all I care about.
The San Francisco Zoo has reopened its big cat grottos. And ever since the tiger mauling on Christmas Day, as Lyra Frederick reports, Bay Area zoos are making some changes.
The big cats have been pacing indoors for 30 days, waiting for the San Francisco Zoo to finish futzing with their outdoor grottos. And spectators will have to wait a few more days as the cats get used to their new digs.
The animals are going to dictate when we can eventually let them in full time and eventually allow the public back to view the big cats and appreciate them.
The zoo spent $1 million ramping up security. Now, cats and humans are separated by a 16.5-foot concrete wall, hot wire, and glass paneling. The trained eye of a security camera will also be monitoring behavior in the area.
From a public standpoint, to make sure that guests are being respectful of the animals, they're not acting unruly.
Across the bay, the Oakland Zoo added 4.5 feet of chain-link fence to their tiger enclosure. But Executive Director Joel Parrott says that even at 12 feet high, it would be an anatomical miracle for a tiger to do a pull-up in order to escape.
The
The truth is there are a lot of large cat exhibits, especially drive-through game parks, that have 9 feet. Still, with so much information out there, about 16 feet is the number that should be. That's what we decided to do.
But Dr. Parrott says a captive wild animal needs more than a wall for a sense of security.
We try to provide them privacy throughout the exhibit so that they can just hide and enough to where they feel comfortable, but they can still be seen.
Animal welfare folks say that the San Francisco Zoo doesn't protect the privacy of their lions and tigers as much as they should.
People should not be allowed to go into the tiger house having that lack of privacy, which has to make them become more aggressive towards people because they never can get away from the people.
And the combination of people and the tiger Tatiana is just what's led Bay Area zoos to re-examine and in some cases rebuild their big cat displays. For CNS News, this is Lyra Frederick.
A national group called Focus the Nation took advantage of political fervor on campuses to hold teach-ins on climate change. Everyone from students to presidential campaign advisors were there. Karen Goldman takes us along.
1 week before the California primary, scientists and policy leaders gathered at the International House to urge UC Berkeley students to make climate change a top political issue.
Unless young people take to the streets and make it clear to this society that these changes have to happen, then everyone's going to be going along in their half measures, believing that that's actually going to solve the problem, and it won't. So it's on you guys.
This was one of hundreds of teach-ins held on campuses across the nation. Event organizers hope this will jumpstart a youth movement.
This is really designed to be the first in a whole series of green networking events. Not so different in spirit than what happened when free speech movement, anti-war movement in the 60s and 70s took off across campuses.
Presidential campaign advisors were present at the teach-in. Henry Stern works closely with Obama's campaign.
He talks about green-collar jobs and green for all and trying to build this new energy economy sustainably, which includes labor.
So far, Obama is the only presidential candidate to endorse Focus the Nation, the group that organized the national teach-ins. For CNS News, this is Kieran Goldman.
And in Oakland, 125 homeless people settled into the nation's first green shelter. Brittany Johnson has the story.
A mile away, but a world apart, residents of the East Oakland Community Project prepared to move into their new home this week. Resident Clavel Coleman was looking forward to a more nurturing environment.
All right. Certain places can make you depressed. You know, I mean, looking forward to something is always good when it's positive.
Crossroads, with its 24,000 square feet of serene, sunlit living space, is a far cry from this former grocery warehouse they rented for 17 years.
It's pretty decrepit. It's not a healthy environment. It's cold, it's dank, it's drafty, it's falling apart around us.
The move this week represents 7 years of tough work fundraising the $11 million to build the type of refuge Jackson believes is critical to providing dignity, good health, and hope.
If you get up and you feel good about where you're getting up, you feel like you can get on with your day. You feel like you can launch your plans. You feel that you can make change. That's the environment that we wanted to create for people.
The green environment Jackson created includes solar panels and hydronic heating, which will lower energy bills. More importantly, since 60% of the residents suffer from serious respiratory ailments, Crossroads features linoleum instead of carpet and non-toxic paint. 3,000 of the people homeless in Alameda County each night belong to families.
Even though a family's in crisis, they should be able to remain an intact family.
In order to keep families together, Crossroads offers 5 private units where children can bathe and sleep with their family.
So that you can wash little guys and they can have their rubber ducky experiences and feel comfortable and still nurtured, even though the family is dealing with some pretty serious issues.
That privacy is a welcome change for single mother Veronica Babb and her 10-year-old daughter Adonis.
There's a comfortable shelter and it looks nice.
Babb is thrilled to get her fourth grader back to school after a 3-month absence, and says their new home has given her renewed hope for the future.
I would like to do something else with my life besides being here in a shelter.
This is Brittany Johnson reporting for CNS News.
We'll be back in a moment, but now here's a look at political phone banking in the Bay Area.
Phone banking is probably one of the most important things that people can do to help candidates win elections.
Making phone calls in states as large as California is really the only way to actually have an opportunity to reach every single voter.
They get all excited and say, yeah, I'm going to go out and I talk to my friends. And so you feel kind of, yeah, that, you know, it makes you feel good.
Each volunteer is given a script to read.
All right, thanks. Bye-bye.
They're actually able to key in a response.
That was cute.
So it allows us to reach so many more people.
I've never volunteered for any political campaign before. I just felt like this time I had to do something.
Well, thank you. We appreciate you. We love you. And she's grateful.
I think phone banking also gets out the undecided voters, because yesterday I was on the phone and I was able to speak to people who were undecided and to sway them.
A recent medical study suggests gay men may be more susceptible to a skin infection that resists many common antibiotics. It's caused a stir in San Francisco's gay community. I went to the Castro to get the story.
The study found high rates of a strain of staph infection known as MRSA in the Castro. But the study's lead scientist said some journalists misinterpreted the study, blaming gay men for spreading the infection.
So here's the little beast right here.
We, as investigators, were a little naive about the political impact.
Headlines like these caused an uproar among gay activists and health workers.
And, of course, the Christian media got a hold of it immediately and proceeded with their demonizing ways of, portraying gay men as a threat to society at large.
Dr. Rick Loftus, a men's health specialist, says MRSA is found in many populations.
It's not as if this problem was generated within the gay community. I mean, where did the MRSA come from? The first group that was really publicized as being affected by this were children in Chicago and other places.
Public health workers held several community meetings to try and set the record straight.
Fourth, I want to make it absolutely clear that MRSA can affect all San Franciscans, and that's gay, straight, bi, lesbian, queer.
And there is cause for concern. According to the Centers for Disease Control, MRSA infections killed over 18,000 people in 2005. Many Castro residents know about the threat.
And I actually know someone who suffered from this and very, very nearly lost a leg. So this is a real issue.
MRSA can lead to pneumonia and infections in the bloodstream, but it can be prevented by taking simple precautions.
Keeping yourself clean, washing your hands, washing your clothing or your towels if you have an active infection, keeping it covered, that kind of stuff. It's basic personal hygiene.
For CNS News, this is Jill Replogle.
California state parks are facing a threat of their own. 48 of them could be shut down, saving more than $13 million. Lauren Rutzer reports.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, come see me.
Crystal Shove is a California state park ranger.
What was life like for you, your age group, back in 1836?
For the last 6 years, she has managed the Petaluma Adobe, educating its many visitors about life in 1836, before California was a state.
What I find exciting is to watch the delight of the fourth graders, because to a fourth grader, imagination is not lost, and they can actually imagine what life was like here.
But Crystal's days working at the Adobe may be numbered. This park and 47 others in California are slated to close in the next 2 years. Brad Schumann visited the Adobe with his son's fourth grade class.
Anytime you can touch and feel and see things, I think you're going to have that memory is going to last longer than learning about it in class or through a book.
For visitors to the Adobe, the park is about education. In Sacramento, the decision is purely financial.
We had finally gotten to the point where we were against the wall and had to make tough choices. Should we die by 1,000 deaths at all of these parks? Or should we close some to preserve the best of others?
There is still time for park lovers to have their say.
The hearings in the legislature have started. That's the place to go, the public hearing, and make your voice known.
I think that the answer is, if our voices are large enough and strong enough, that the legislature will have no problem finding this money.
Elizabeth Goldstein doesn't like the proposed closures. She is trying to rally park supporters.
It's not very much money at all in the scheme of the budget that they're looking at this year.
The plan to close the parks isn't final yet, so life at the Adobe goes on as normal, and Crystal Schoaf is optimistic.
I have great hope that things will be positive for the park today, because I really think of it as my park, so I have great hope.
For CNS News, this is Lauren Rutzer reporting.
Now, here's what some East Bay voters had to say moments after casting their ballots.
I'm supporting Mitt Romney.
I just changed my registration from Green to Democrat.
I'm nonpartisan.
Republican. Look, I don't, you know, run around town screaming I'm a Republican.
I think that it's hard to be a Republican if you have this sort of fiscal Republican attitude, but you're kind of liberal in social issues. I think it's been very embarrassing for them.
Well, I think there's been a lot of mistakes made. I think you started out all right, but I think people are tired of it.
This administration has run its course.
Oh, overjoyed. Yeah, it's time.
No matter who you are, you'd like to see things done a lot better than they have been.
Tonight we have three stories about artists who've left the galleries and theaters to practice their crafts in the most unlikely spaces. First we go to San Francisco, where a prestigious artist-in-residence program has risen from the rubble. Emma Cott takes us to the city dump to find out more.
It's Paul Soseski's first day on the job, and he's already struck gold.
The Eagle has landed.
But Soseski isn't your standard employee at NorCal Waste.
That's perfect. Look at that.
He's the company's latest artist in residence. That's right, the city's official dumpster diver. For the next 4 months, he'll get $2,000 a month, on-site studio space, and of course, 24-hour access to all the materials he'll ever need. His mandate? To turn trash into treasure. That concept, to educate about the importance of recycling, launched the artist program almost 2 decades ago. Today, San Francisco produces 3,400 tons of trash a day, but leads the country in recycling. It redirects 69% of its waste. That's almost twice the national average.
We really think that people kind of connect with artists and with art rather than trying to pound a message of recycling.
Soseski is searching for old bike and machine parts to complete his vision.
I'm trying to build these interactive carnival games for people to play with. I kind of do this kind of stuff anyway. I'm always cobbling together old pieces of junk and art and stuff.
While Soseski scavenges, Scott Oliver celebrates. Oliver was one of two artists who finished up his residency last week.
Something gets discarded, and its value becomes, like, subjective. You know, like, I get to decide what it means, or you get to decide what it means.
Even the music you're hearing was pulled from the trash heap. Oliver collected hundreds of discarded records, some of them still in their original packaging.
It's amazing how special everything looks. I wouldn't have thought that everything would have come from the dump. Actually, if I was just like at some gallery in the Mission, I wouldn't have known. So it makes you think about what you throw away. Sure.
For CNS News, this is Emma Cott reporting.
Until now, San Francisco's program has been one of a kind. But last month, the Seattle Dump selected its first pair of artists to lead that city to an even greener future. And now, reporter Molly Snyder-Fink takes us to Oakland, where an unconventional acting company performs a play that carries an important message.
Every week, Donna Foley directs the Seldom Seen Acting Company, a group of homeless men and women in plays they've written. Today, they're performing for middle schoolers in Oakland.
They wrote this short play. It's called Now You Know. Because people would ask them questions. Well, what's it like to be homeless? Or where do you stay? Or what do you do? So this is their answer.
Wear a coat when it's hot. I try to hide the needle marks I've got. I'm a dope fiend.
The plays deal with the struggles of homelessness. But Donna says it's mutual accountability and special friendships among the actors that can be transformative.
His mind is set on an anchor steam pipe.
4 years ago, Michael Goddard left prison for life on the streets. He writes to raise awareness of the struggles of being homeless.
I'm working on a thing called Humanity Versus Humans, because we've lost our humanity being human beings. And you can see that on buses, on subways, in restaurants and stores. It's just mind-boggling, but it's out there, and so I'm going to write about it.
J.R. Rodriguez lived in his van for months after getting evicted. Now he says performing with the company has helped him rebuild his self-esteem.
But this is my way of getting out of the streets. I just believe if people don't believe in themselves, nobody will believe in them. See, the saying goes, you gotta love yourself before you gotta love someone else.
So far, the Seldom Seen Acting Company has performed over 15 plays. Their next play is February 13th at St. Vincent de Paul in Oakland. This is Molly Snyder-Fink for CNS News.
And in Silicon Valley, professionals are finding a creative way to conquer stress and isolation by dancing the high-tech blues away. Annabelle Peavy has the story.
Hetty McAdams has a difficult job.
I'm a mediator, a private mediator.
She helps people avoid a messy situation after difficult decisions have been made. As difficult as her job is, Hetty has a recipe for relaxation. On weekends, she takes on a new identity, that of a line dance teacher.
I graduated from law school in 87, started my practice in 89, and very shortly thereafter I was teaching. I was invited to teach about 6 months after I started line dancing.
A demographic profile of her students would reveal a few common denominators. They are all successful, middle-aged or older, Silicon Valley professionals looking for a way to blow off steam without having to face the need for a partner.
I love the music. I've always loved the music, and I've always loved to dance. And for a great portion of my life, I've been single, and line dancing is just a perfect venue for a single person because you can go out and dance and you don't have to worry about not having a partner.
For the 40, 50, and even 60-year-olds who come to the class, this is their time off from work, from family, and from stressful social commitments.
It's good exercise. And then sometimes when you're dancing, if you think of anything else, you would get stumped.
But why only line dance?
Health benefits are tremendous. Dance is the very best thing you can do for overall musculoskeletal fitness. And then the brain. It's fabulous for the brain. Dance is the only exercise that's been proven to ward off dementia and Alzheimer's.
And?
So if you can do the tush push,
you're on.
You can go anywhere. You can
anywhere.
You can go to any country.
The saddle rack.
Go to the rodeo club.
So these and people are really
and you won't get thrown out.
You won't get
and
thrown
nobody
out.
Will laugh at you.
Nobody will laugh.
Get the tush push is your ticket in.
For CNS News, this is Annabelle Peavy.
That's it for CNS News. Thanks for watching. I'm Jordan Ehrlich.
And I'm Jill Replogle. See you next time.
You've been listening to a podcast from University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at www.uctv.tv. Thank you for listening.